First order of business is an update on the community land trust.
Randy, go ahead.
Thank you. So tonight I was going to provide a presentation updating the council on the Columbia Community Land Trust. We do have a couple board members here in the back, Susan Mays and Alex LeBrunery. So I wanted to point them out. But really tonight is to begin the discussion of talking about moving the Columbia Community Land Trust out from the city to its own independent operations. With the pandemic hitting and additional CARES Act funds hitting our division, additional needs and additional responsibilities, that's really brought this forward further. And the end of our agreement between the city and the Columbia Community Land Trust ends December 31st of 2021. So that's only a year and a couple months out, so that'll get here before we know it. So I think it's really prudent to start beginning the discussion of how we make a separation that's mutually beneficial and good interest of both the city and the Columbia Community Land Trust. So these are my goals for tonight. Update the council on progress. I thought it'd be good to touch on community land trust just a little bit. I know the council hears a lot of information on a variety of things, and this is pretty niche, so I thought it'd be good just to refresh a little bit of that. Touch on what the progress to date has been, some of the challenges, the Columbia Community Land Trust beyond 2021, and then some potential options for 2021 and beyond. And really wanted to take tonight to throw some options out, all this information, and get council considerations on what some direction from council you'd like to see as we move forward. I do have a lot in this presentation, and I went through it a couple times on my own. It's probably the full 30 minutes. I have allotted maybe a little bit more if there's questions. So I erred on the side of including more information than less, so we'll dive in. So as we begin, I think it's good to begin the conversation about the Columbia Community Land Trust a little bit further back on affordable housing in general. What we do when we fund affordable housing, whether it be for home ownership or rental, we are filling the gap between what it costs to develop an affordable or a unit of housing, as well as what an affordable price is for the intended end user or buyer. So we're always filling that gap with resources or land donations or permit fee waivers, things like that. And what we know is over time, that gap has grown. That gap's grown since I've been in my position and started here in 2011. I've seen that gap widen from 30 to 50,000 per unit to 50 to 80, depending on site considerations. And with the pandemic, I think we're seeing that gap continue to widen further. So I think that points to the benefits of having an organization like the Columbia Community Land Trust, protecting those investments, knowing that that gap's going to widen for the future, so to look after those investments. This is a slide I provided several months back, so it should be somewhat familiar to council. It was quite a while ago, but it just demonstrates some costs over on Lynn Street, what that subsidy gap was. It's pretty large, about $90,000, but that those costs include home construction, soft costs like engineering, land infrastructure, solar panels, kind of the full package there. And looking at what other cities are doing across our country, I got this data about 6 months ago. I think this slide was included in a council report I did about the same time length ago. These are what cities are doing with their community land trust specific single family detached home buyer properties. So you can see we're in the mix there, a little bit higher than Lawrence or Springfield, less than Houston or Denver. Denver, of course, market is really rapidly appreciating. Houston wanted to serve a much lower income level, so that gives you some context of kind of where we sit. There's another slide I provided months back, just giving some context to per square foot costs for some of our previous projects. I also added our current Colmore Cottages project on what that per square foot costs. Those costs are construction, hard costs only, it doesn't include land, pre-development, other soft costs. But it gives you a sense between properties. You can see some of the housing authority jobs got up there a bit where they ran into some termites and additional work needing to be done. But that's what it varies on that slide. I thought it'd be good to talk about who our key partners are. And when I say our, I wear a couple hats, so I kind of shift in and out of my hat of this city person as the person, you know, supporting the Columbia Community Land Trust. But as far as the Columbia Community Land Trust key partners are, the city, of course, is at the top. If you look at the 2019 review of financial statements, it was also provided with this work session materials. 90% of the funds in the Columbia Community Land Trust are through the city. So a significant amount of resources. And that was 2019. I expect 2020 to be a little bit lower than that because they've got some donations and a large project that they're using some of those donations on. Other key partners are community housing development organizations. That's a home or HUD designation for nonprofit housing developers. Specific ones in our community are Habitat for Humanity, Job Point, CMCA. Habitat, in fact, built our first Columbia Community Land Trust Chodo house, and they intend to build more, and Job Point and CMCA have also assisted. Another way we've been utilizing the land trust as a mechanism is to access additional private capital through our local community banks and private builders to get us some more capacity to do more homes. So that's really two very different functions that we've been doing with the land trust, so it's good to keep that in mind. The top one where we're working with just the Chodos, receiving land into the land trust, looking after the resales, that's a little bit lesser of a role, but really at the heart of what the Columbia Community Land Trust is. The other item where we're, you know, accessing more funds in the private market, that's one that really pushes, demands staff time a bit more, but does produce more homes. So how do we currently provide affordability through the Columbia Community Land Trust? Donation of land, CDBG and home funding, water and light funds for some of our solar panels, permit fee waivers, also fundraising now, and it's good that we've had some because that's had to fill some of the gap that's been caused over on Coolmore Cottages with some of the increase in wood prices that we've seen in the last 6 months. And then below market development financing through our local community banks that helps fund some of that gap as well. So shifting more directly to community land trusts, it's good to think about a comparison of traditional homeownership programs to the community land trust model. We still do operate a traditional homeownership program through our down payment assistance program. The assistance is provided as a secondary lien on the property that's forgiven over time. There's no long-term protections, but serves as a good wealth-generating opportunity for that buyer. And little ongoing support or contact after the program. Community land trust model is different in that we still provide that subsidy, but we keep the subsidy with the property, look after that subsidy, make sure the home resales to income qualified buyers. So I think most councils are probably familiar with that. So how we do that is we retain the ownership of the land, lease the land, authorize the use of land through a long-term lease to the homeowner. And that lease also controls future resales, ensuring the property stays well-maintained, owner-occupied for the next buyers. So the benefits are homes remain affordable from homeowner to homeowner without requiring additional city subsidy. We've had a couple resales here in the process. We have noticed there are some costs with those resales, but none that would warrant us needing to come back to the city. But just wanted to throw that in there. Public and private resources are preserved and leveraged over time. So that's the benefits, and that's a good benefit where we see rising costs and a bigger gap to fund. But there is additional work required over the traditional model. Thinking about ongoing stewardship with current homeowners that have questions or need support or going to resell, that does demand time and attention beyond what we've done in the past in terms of the traditional model. Originally, when we were planning this, we had estimated 4 hours per week for staff time or 208 hours per year. Through a time study we did with our accountant, we came out to closer to 25 hours per week or about 1,300 per year. Now, that first item, our original plans were for 12 homes over 5 years, and we're probably going to hit about 20. So I think that's part of that demand. But I also do think that ongoing stewardship is something that we do need to put more attention to going forward in terms of the staff demands. Some progress to date. The Columbia Community Land Trust has a 2-year strategic plan that we did back in 2019 that covers through the end of our agreement. Intentionally made that as the break point. The board updated their mission and vision, refined it a bit, so they have more ownership of what that is, which is a good thing. But each year they've operated, they've had a strategic plan that's guided by organizational goals, financial goals, and housing production goals, and that was included in the materials. On that goal sheet that I included in the materials, I had red, yellow, and green check marks. Green means that we're doing really good, getting it done, or already done. Yellow means we're on track. Red means we're behind. I think it's good to consider the CCLT's role. And this kind of goes back to my slide a few back. You know, our role is really to receive those Habitat, Job Point, and CMCA properties and look after those for future buyers, and then also fill capacity to complete additional homes through the private builders and local community banks. So that's been the two roles we've been doing. The first one is less demanding. The second one definitely has more demands with it. So some goals, where we're ahead of schedule, I won't read through all these, but they're included in the materials. I think common themes that you'll see where we're ahead or doing well is producing homes and then building out our financial procedures and how we track and account for funds. I think in my mind, that's what we need to lead with, because I think the sooner we have homes in the portfolio and good procedures to track funds, the more that will push the land trust to being more independent and sustainable. I do think we need more attention to stewardship going forward, because we're getting more and more homeowners that need attention or questions answered. Goals where we're a little bit behind schedule, receiving the 7 and 9 Third Avenue properties that Job Point has just now completed. They got a little hung up with COVID hitting on some of their final punch list, but they're both on the market, and I think we'll receive those this year or early next year. Also developing communication plans specified between staff and the board and council and how that all works. We are crafting a gift acceptance policy, or I've crafted one that kind of outlines some of that and gets to that. I think we need to do more work there. But I think this discussion and then working over the next year to figure out how we put the Columbia Community Land Trust in an independent, sustainable role will help with that item as well. So significant accomplishments that come to my mind specifically, I think having 10 homes completed in portfolio with two on the way and eight in development is good accomplishments. Each of our monthly statements since the inception of the Columbia Community Land Trust has been reconciled by a third-party accounting firm. So staff has not signed off on any purchases. The board, at least two officers, sign off on purchases, and then third-party accountant reconciles all that, so I think we have really good accounting for our expenditures. We have an audit firm set up to do an audit of our 2020 year, and we did a tiered approach where they did a review of financial statements for 2019, and that was kind of the flow I wanted to go from doing a compiled statement from our third-party firm to a review of financial statements and then on to a full audit. And we expect the report on the 2020 audit to come probably July, August of next year, which could be a good informing point for parting with the city, looking at, you know, where do we need to strengthen procedures or modify anything. They've had financial records since the get-go, which was really good in 2017. All of their information is on their web, so it's very easy to find out, you know, how they operate, what the Columbia Community Land Trust does. We're having additional interest from local banks, realtors, and builders bidding on the work, so that's a positive thing. And we've received approximately $100,000 in donations over the last 12 months. And as of the end of September, we didn't have any unpaid ground lease payments. So those are all positive things in my mind. As I mentioned earlier, our agreement ends December 31st of 2021. So the vision's been for the Columbia Community Land Trust to be separate from the city at a point in time at which that can sustain itself. I think there's an opportunity for an advantageous, mutually beneficial relationship where the CCLT can help protect public investments and affordable housing going forward. And certainly the city being the primary funder is definitely a benefit to the Columbia Community Land Trust, or has been. Kind of shifting gears more globally with the Housing Programs Division and my team, which is a little more broad than just the Columbia Community Land Trust. Staffing the Columbia Community Land Trust has been very rewarding and fun to be a part of, and a good initiative. It's also stretched us a bit at times. And certainly, with any good endeavor, you need to be stretched a little bit. But with COVID, that's had a very cumulative impact on myself and my staff, needing to address bigger needs that relate directly to our primary job duties. So our annual budget's usually around 1.5 to 2 million, depending on how many loan payments, payoffs we get, and that's for the Housing Programs Division as a whole, not the Columbia Community Land Trust. And we have about 1.3 in additional CDBG CV funds, or CARES Act funds through CDBG, allocated to us for recovery. So that's, you know, almost double what we would normally have. So that means double the amount of funding processes, getting partners to identify how to use the funds, getting the funds out the door. So it's definitely put a strain on my staff, but we're getting things done. But it's pushed the need to help get the Columbia Community Land Trust out on its own even further. And the Housing Programs Division is potentially going to access some additional County CARES Act funds for business loans. So that's another big item. So I would think that the additional demands on our on my team will probably last at least 2 to 3 more years. I know there's likely going to be the potential for additional stimulus that could be even further. And those are items, our long-term recovery and addressing the impacts of COVID on our community right now. It seemed like where we should have our attention laser focused. I think there's certainly roles the land trust can play in some of that, but it's on a more narrow level right now. It could be broader in the future, but not right now. And my team needs to be attending to what's the task at hand right now. So ongoing risks of not being intentional about looking for a positive separation is decreased ability for my staff, myself, to be effective in all areas of our duties, and challenges in navigating new and changing regulations. You know, there was a lot of waivers with the CARES Act, which has helped us, but a lot of those interrelate to other regulations that HUD's releasing a lot of additional guidance out, and we know we're going to have an audit of how we use CARES Act funds, a year to 18 months from now, so we want to make sure we do things right. So having demands outside of that puts a little bit of strain on it. So our current administrative services agreement, it began on January 10th of 2017, and it's a 5-year agreement. The first 3 were free. We're in the 4th year. The Columbia Community Land Trust is not covering any staffing costs in year 4. The agreement's written in a manner that says that could be charged in year 5, so that's an option. But it basically spells out what we do, and it's pretty much all the meat and potatoes of running the Columbia Community Land Trust. The board is very active, engaged, and does very thoughtful discussions and makes very thoughtful decisions as far as doing the day-to-day. The staff does most of that. I'm number 21 in there. I just wanted to make a quick point. Says that we should put our primary job duties before the Columbia Community Land Trust. And that was really good to have that in agreement early on. We're at a point now where it's not practical to ever enforce that. Just with resales of Columbia Community Land Trust properties, there's just certain tasks that we can't say we're not going to get to that without really adversely impacting the land trust. So it just means additional time spent. So the administrative services agreement, I think there's 3 options that I've reflected upon that would be worth considering how we move forward after 2021. There might be some nuances or permutations to each of these, but I think really there's 3. The first one would be extending the current contract for a period of time, if it's 2 years, 3 years, whatever that might be. I think the benefits, but I think also growing at a slower pace, just receiving those CHOTO-funded homes is the only way I would, or that's the way I would recommend if that were the choice. The benefits, it's less risk for maintaining sustainable operations, less disruption. The drawbacks are less opportunity for expansive growth, continued demands on each housing programs division staff that has other things to our attention at the moment. And then it maintains the city CLT relationship, with at times has had potential conflict points, and we'd have to maintain that for a longer duration. Item number two, or option number two, would be to merge the Columbia Community Land Trust with another existing nonprofit housing provider. That could be a really good thing. The benefit could be it could strengthen the CCLT and that other provider if it's a really strategic alignment. May provide operational capacity with things like HR, healthcare plans, things like that. And it's a little bit less risk for sustainable operations. The drawbacks are, its mission could be encumbered or overshadowed by other entities. And there are significant details to work out in bylaws, the 501c3 status, and not only would the Columbia Community Land Trust be negotiating that with that other nonprofit, the city probably would have some interest in that as well. So you'd have three entities, and it could be navigated, but that could also present some challenges. I think the third option, moving out on its own, is the third option. It maximizes the opportunity for creativity or expansive growth, empowers the board to have more responsibility for the future of the vision. I think it is a much higher risk for maintaining sustainable operations. There'd have to be a lot of details worked out on hiring an ED and how that would look budgetarily for beyond 3 years. And would need a pretty significant funding plan and capital campaign, but they've had good success in that so far. So I think any of these options could be met, but they all just have different benefits and different drawbacks. I would lean towards either two or three, just given the current state of the demands on my division. This is the Columbia Community Land Trust financial statement through September of 2020. Got both their assets and liabilities on the next slide. About 409 in total assets. They have a pretty good checking account, considering where they've started years ago. The ground lease account continues to grow and hasn't been accessed for any expenditures, and the plan would be to keep doing that through the next year and a half to let that build, which is good.
Randy, could I ask you, what the ground lease account is?
Yeah, so each Columbia Community Land Trust homeowner is required to pay a very modest fee of $40 per month to help support the ongoing operations of the Columbia Community Land Trust. So those go directly into the ground lease fee account.
Then what happens with that money?
Right now, we're just letting it build, but the idea would be that it could be a source to cover a portion of the operating costs of the Columbia Community Land Trust. And that's pretty standard on most community land trusts across the country. What they charge varies depending on your specific location.
Okay, thank you.
Randy, for the land that's booked on the previous page or on this page, did the land trust acquire that land? Did the city own that land and give it to the land trust, or does the city continue to own that land?
Each of all the land that the land trust has been donated to the land trust by the city. And with that comes, we record our agreement that has all the rules and regulations. We record that at the county, and then take the deed and book page number of that and plug it in to the deed when we deed it over, so we tie all those regulations to the property.
I've got a couple more questions, but I'll let you finish.
Okay. Good. And this is just our liabilities and equities from our financial statement of 2020. So I did a three-year budget projection that I have in front of me. I didn't include the full detail to the council. I included just the revenues, but if you want the expenditures, I have sheets for everybody. Always weigh how much to provide. So I did a projection for 2021 through 2023, and the land trust follows January to December as their fiscal year, since that's what our CDBG and home program is. And I included covering staff costs in 2021, so that'd be next year, even if it has not separated from the city yet at that time. It includes transitioning away from the city and either becoming an independent organization or merging with an existing nonprofit in 2022. getting to 22 homes by the end of 2023. The budget that I put together, a projection, is what I think are known sources and within a realm of reason. So it's not a large, expansive growth. It kind of trends with what we've been funding the land trust year after year. And that's what it looks like. So donations have the land trust needing to get raise at least $50,000, $65,000, and $70,000 over the 3 years. Selling Coolmore Cottage homes here in 2021, and additional homes in 2022. We've got two more Coolmore Cottages homes once they sell the first five that we would have planned on providing to the land trust. And then we have two additional properties over on Hickman. Those are our properties and agreements that have not have been approved by council, but we'd put before you for consideration in the coming years if that's, you know, the direction we continue going. The area where they don't have a source identified would be some of that operations grants, the $35,000 per year in 2022 and 2023, but they could look to other sources to apply for those funds. But if all those revenues came in, I think they're all within reach. It could be out on its own to a certain degree. So the CCLT beyond the city, just in summary real quick, and this is my last slide. The five-year services agreement expires December 31st of next year. COVID has definitely pushed forward the need for this discussion, as well as the end date coming up. And staff plans to work with the board to continue building capacity, both financially and procedurally, and help them think about transition beyond 2021.
Thanks. And we have a few minutes for questions, but we do have a hard stop at 6:59 so that we can start this 7 o'clock meeting on time at 7. I completely support the seed grant that the city has given to the land trust, but I do support, and it's timely, for that land trust to begin to stand on its own. And so I'm glad to see the budget that you've generated. Is there an existing not-for-profit? You don't necessarily have to name names here, but it seems to me that rather than extend the current agreement past December 2021, that we use the next 12 months to explore the transfer of that. And does that fit? It seems to me that some type of partnership with the Columbia Housing Authority seems appropriate, especially as people slide up and down that continuum of housing, that there may be people in the Housing Authority that may be a potential buyer for this. There may be existing people in this home that, you know, have a change of circumstances that are on a bubble and slide back into the Housing Authority. Does that make sense to you? Is that
definitely
one of the options?
Definitely. I think that would be a very strategic option worth exploring for sure. I know we were working with the Housing Authority early on for them to be the entity that took this on, and the RAD conversion program came around. So they actually have two properties that were intended for the Community Land Trust Initiative, where they have renters in those properties, and it's generating revenue that could be another stream. I think as far as strategic alignment to hit all the different parts of the continuum of housing, from shelter to rental to home ownership, that could be very strategic to explore.
Second question is, I remain concerned that $183,000 for a home is not affordable. I mean, that's a solid middle class home that we should all want to be within reach of everyone, but in terms of, I don't know that fits in the portfolio of affordable housing. When you go to sell that $183,000 developed cost home, what portion do you ascribe to the land, and what is within ballpark? I'm sensitive to the privacy of the buyer and seller. What is the asking price, if you will, of that home?
We set our price on 80% of getting an 80% loan to value ratio of the appraised value, which is often much lower than what it costs to develop these homes in some of the neighborhoods where we're developing, because homes just won't appraise out. So that typically means, like on Coolmore Cottages, our next project, Those homes, the standard three-bedroom, two-bath, I think will appraise for around 150, I would bet. And they'll sell for around, between 110 and 115, depending on how both those numbers work out. And that seems to hit a pretty good number of buyers, between 50 and 80% AMI. We want to subsidize enough to where we don't come in, our threshold is 80%, the area median income. We don't want to subsidize getting people right at 78 or 79, because we want to get enough eligible buyers that we can get a pool. I've really struggled with the costs of the home. I think we made some improvements on the Colmore Cottages project on getting some more competitive pricing on several things. We do get a lot of feedback from program participants about liking features like a garage, hardy board siding, facades that match the historic nature of the neighborhood, solar panels. And as a staff, we like meeting the needs that are expressed to us and all of those items as well. But collectively, those items do add up. The affordable housing challenge isn't one thing. It's a lot of things that go into it. It's the cost of the land, the development, the material costs, financing costs. But you mentioned the land costs. All the lot costs on Colmore Cottages for the 10 homes we're building, if you include in the cost of the land, the stormwater, all those costs, it's about $20,200 where we're at. Much lower than what we did on Lynn Street. It was like around 45, I think. So I think we've made some improvements and gains there. We did think we were ahead of the game on our building costs, but wood prices spiked by about 25%, so we had a little bit of a setback there from the time we chose our builder to when we're starting. I think you're right that we do need to think about, do we need garages on every home we build if it's in a walkable neighborhood? Do we need solar panels on every home? But also holding the line on making sure we're not writing off the needs of low-income people to be in really high-quality housing. Balancing those, that's a challenge.
My last question is, I know you've received a number of anonymous contributions in the previous year, and while I don't want to discourage anonymous contributions, but I also don't want to create any potential conflict or avenue for conflict. And I don't know that a not-for-profit can accept anonymous contributions. I know anonymous contributions can't be their top 5 or 10 sources of revenue. I'm just all the more reason to divorce this from an extension of the city into its own freestanding. I just don't like the transparency of anonymous contributions for a city-supported entity.
I did put a gift acceptance policy before the board at the last meeting, it needed some further discussion, but a lot of that discussion, seems like the discussion is forcing that issue, that it's just naturally an awkward fit when that's there.
Thank you, and I trust you, I trust your judgment, and Mr. LeBrunery and Ms. Mays, thank you for your service on the board as well. We have time for Mr. Scala.
Just quickly, this comes down to risks. You've indicated that you favor either the emerging with a nonprofit or the independence route at this point. I take it that the risk for keeping it within the city has to do with the workload on the staff and so on. That gets an increasing workload. The risks along with emerging become kind of a loss of mission control, if you will, and a loss of that, although it's kind of a nice apprenticeship program because it fits that category. And the last one is kind of risky because folks are on their own and they have a high, there's a high learning curve, if you will, and it's risky in that regard. But given that you favor either two or three, and I suspect we're headed in that direction, seems like the mayor's suggestion to be able to study this, the question becomes, are there any takers for the merge? And you've indicated there may be some interest in that, although you've not, no one has actively sought that input as of yet. Have you? I mean, have you gone out to find out whether or not there is that kind of interest in it? Or
I haven't actively sought that. Just knowing, having been doing this for years, I would anticipate there is. But I would certainly want to approach the board, make sure I have their blessing, involve them in that discussion, make sure everybody is working together.
In your opinion, though, this baby has this baby. We've given birth to this baby to the extent that an independent group could take it over. I mean,
absolutely. I think if there was strategic alignment, it could be very beneficial for another organization that's doing a similar mission. I wouldn't paint too rosy of a picture in that it is additional work and additional commitment, and it's something unique that no other organization does, so there is a learning curve. So I don't think that should be underestimated. Or if an organization is eager to take it over, without thinking that through, that would give me pause. I would want to make sure that they've done their due diligence.
Any additional questions? None. Thank you.
Thank you.
And sorry to run you short, Director Teddy, but if you could bring us up to speed on where we are, because I forgot where we were.
As soon as I find my slide deck, I'll start. Well, good evening, and this is a report that we have on the end of your agenda tonight. So I anticipated that Mr. Cole's presentation would be both detailed and in a sense more important than this. We just wanted to preview that it's back. The short-term rentals ordinance, which consists of amendments to the Unified Development Code, rental certificate program code, the business license code, and the lodging taxation code is coming back before you on December 7th. And of that, the one that's been problematic has been the land development code, deciding the districts where short-term rentals should be allowed, if they are allowed, and under what conditions. And make some prefatory remarks here, just some trends since the pandemic was announced in March. What seems to be happening in the short-term rental landscape, both generally and locally. First of all, we saw a steep drop in bookings during the stay-at-home phase of the health orders, and that was completely expected, of course. People would stop traveling for a time. So like other types of lodging, there was that. However, during the reopening phases, and this is true, I think, locally as well as nationally, there's been a certain rebound and even some gaining of share, if you will, of the short-term rentals, Airbnb and such, relative to hotels, despite the fact that the hotel industry is well-equipped to clean and maintain a clean, safe environment for their guests. Perhaps the phenomenon is guests feel a little more comfortable isolating themselves in a lodging where they just have to worry about who was there a few nights before and not who's around them in their immediate surroundings. We've not seen a whole lot of code violations locally, code violation complaints, that is. I'm not saying that it's not still a public concern. I just want to report to you that our phone's not lighting up with people saying, hey, there's a short-term rental on my block and it's bothering me. We just have had very little of that activity since the pandemic began, or the pandemic response began. We've seen internationally, actually, adaptive response of the platforms to COVID-19, where they're instituting special cleaning programs and they're telling their hosts they can qualify for special badge that they display on their listings to certify that they're clean and safe. So they're There's definitely an interest on the part of the platforms or the intermediaries, as we call them in the ordinance, to try to garner more share of the travel market. It's been written that travelers and tourists are making shorter trips, and they're choosing more of these getaway locations. They're not going to the Disneylands and the tourist districts, if you will, as much as they are finding places that are just simply nice and not crowded, for reasons that are fairly obvious, making drive-to trips rather than fly-to trips also. And then some communities have been coming out with new regulations, including some have banned them because they think of them as businesses that don't belong in residential areas, and there's a compounding concern in some cases, probably in the big tourist towns with COVID-19 and the potential for spread. And then the number of short-term rentals in our community are approximately equivalent to two average-sized hotels. The number that's given is 274 currently active listings. This comes from Ms. Schneider in Convention and Visitors Bureau. And she's also noted the trend of STRs having higher occupancy rates than conventional lodgings during this period. Just to recap of where we've been with this, and this is just the council's history with the ordinance. The Chapter 29 or Unified Development Code amendments were introduced in November last year, so just about exactly a year ago. And then an ordinance was tabled from December 2nd to January 21st. In the interim, there was a work session held so that council could be briefed on some of the details of the ordinance. And then there was a public hearing on the 21st. And then, as you can see, there's other code chapters that are involved in that. But I would dare say that those are less controversial at this point, although there are some hosts, of course, that are concerned about their costs brought on by the various license fees, taxes, and certificate fees. February 3rd, the amendments that council had considered were approved by council, so you had an amended ordinance at that point, and you referred it back to the Planning and Zoning Commission. There was a report done on the consolidated draft, so this was working those several amendments. I think there were eight or nine that were voted in the various ordinances. There were six that were of concern for the Planning and Zoning Commission because they're in the Unified Development Code. And then Planning and Zoning Commission had a work session to study those in February. They had a public hearing March 5th and received quite a number of comments in person and in writing. The commission, as I believe council remembers, did not recommend the ordinance as presented, and the vote was 8 voting no, only 1 voting yes. And then there was a further vote to ask council to refer the ordinance back to the commission for further proceedings, whatever those might look like. So they did indicate a willingness to give greater consideration or further consideration to the ordinance. You also asked for feedback from the Housing and Community Development Commission. Mr. Cole staffs that, so he had them provide a memo to council. Also, and I left it off the slide, apologize, Human Services Commission also weighed in, and the focus of both of those groups was the possible impacts on affordable housing, and both said that if there are gonna be some fees paid, perhaps some of those fees should be reserved for affordable housing purposes, and Housing and Community Development Commission went so far as to say that could be part of our competitive process. However, that commission stopped short of saying there's an issue now. They saw it as something that could that could possibly develop with the growth of that phenomenon. Then you tabled it to June 1st, and then in June 1st, when we looked at our situation here, we, the staff, did recommend tabling it for a period of time, and that's how we got here with the thing is now pending December 7th. So turning to the report that we did for tonight, and Mr. Zenner's here, he's the liaison to the Planning and Zoning Commission. He can fill you in with some details or answer your questions, but we took those six amendments and looked at them one by one with the commission. And as you can see in the report, we recorded their response. Really, it's kind of a polling process. They didn't have the benefit of the usual hearing setting or even a formal proceeding in this chamber, but they went around on each one and indicated by voting how they felt about them. It looks like, it looks like three of the six, there is a little bit of traction there, and an example is the provision that allows for an administrative process for a residential property where the owner is hosting the Airbnb, and that includes the flexibility of not requiring that owner host to actually be present in their own house when the guest is there, but to either they would be available or a designated agent, as we call it, would be made available through their application process. So you'd have somebody that could respond to neighbor complaints, for example. So that was the process they went through, and it's not strong majorities, but I think you have three of the six where there was some movement, perhaps with a little bit of redrafting, that there would be support for those. There's still concern about how is maximum occupancy going to be calculated. We're kind of in different places on that, on how big you can make an Airbnb, for example, or a short-term rental, I should call it. There's still concern about what was proposed in the council's version of the ordinance, where you'd allow someone who qualifies as an owner host to allow an adjacent property that they might own get that approved through administrative process. That was not favored by the commission, if you recall that particular amendment. And there was also the issue of allowing additional intensity, if you will, or occupancy through a conditional use process. You have some division on that. The second of the two work sessions really wasn't getting into so much just voting on the individual changes, but looking at the ordinance as a whole and trying to get a sense of the commission. And there it was fairly clear to us staff that there's a pretty strong majority that in favor of these small-scale hosted operations, what they refer to as the mom-and-pop short-term rental, where it is an owner-host, and typically they're renting by the rooms, but they might do something where, for a limited time, they're renting their whole house while they're on sabbatical or vacation, what have you. So it seemed like there was a desire of the commission to get there. It kind of breaks down when you talk about these unhosted or investor-owned properties, where someone might be out of town, they're not from the neighborhood. They just own that property. They want to make some income off of it. They see that as going farther from kind of the original model, which is when these platforms, Airbnb, for example, goes back only to 2008 when they entered the scene. They were appealing primarily to people that had a little excess capacity in their house, and it was a nice way to market that excess capacity, those extra rooms, to people that would come stay in them. And that original model was so successful that it really drew interest of kind of a whole investment community that capable of buying up properties, and that's where you get in that phenomenon the concern about driving up house prices or just simply taking houses that might be more affordable relative to the housing stock and kind of taking those out of circulation because the host is making more per night than they would through conventional rental. So we got a dilemma indeed on this, but probably my general question to the council is, do you feel this is the time to pick this back up and go with it? Are these the times? It is an issue that has drawn, I won't say huge crowds, but it's drawn people to City Hall to talk about this, so maybe that's where our discussion ought to start.
So we have no more than 5 minutes to have this discussion. We do have a report at the end of the meeting, but I appreciate the update or the reminder about how we got here. Anybody want to tackle this? Dr. Peters.
I just have a question about how many complaints we've actually gotten or your office has received regarding Airbnbs. Do you have any idea with 274 Airbnbs?
Within what time period, ma'am?
In the last year.
Well, in the last year, I don't have those data, but if that's what you're interested, we could retrieve what we call citizen requests and look for the notation that it is related to.
I'm just wondering how many. I mean, this sounds like a very complicated procedure, and I'm not like exactly opposed to it, but it seems massively convoluted, and I'm just wondering how much of a problem it is we're fixing with this or not.
This being the ordinance that's proposed?
Right.
Well, if you get to the point where, or we get to the point where we are registering these things, for one, there's a revenue opportunity there.
Right.
And leaving aside that there's certain areas perhaps where these don't belong, I mean, there is that. So it will create some revenue that will help support us in our efforts to register and document them. Right now, we're not documenting them. The listings that you find online are not address specific. If you go to a listing, it will say, nice location in Columbia. It might have a reference to a football stadium or a park like Stevens Lake Park, but there's not information you can get just from browsing the public-facing side of a platform where you can compile a list.
And I realize some of it has to do with if the hotels pay tax, why doesn't the Airbnb pay tax?
But yeah, that's how this whole started.
Yeah, I know how that started, and it just gets... Is it owner-occupied or not quite owner-occupied or owner-occupied but next door to owner-occupied, but the owner isn't really there, but the owner's sort of there when there's not somebody else there unless they're on sabbatical? It just sort of goes on and on.
Well, it's this idea that if someone is renting out their house to somebody as a tourist guest,
right.
Some are comfortable with the idea both on the guest side and the host side of being there together. But that's more like, you know, that's you're offering a room in that case.
Right.
Others want to offer the whole house. So the ordinance was crafted so that you could have a host actually give up their
house. Yeah, I understand it. I'm just saying that it's just confusing.
Now, the industry thinks of hosted really as rental by the room, though. And those right now are probably less than a third of the total, I would guess.
Okay, thank you.
Whole house is more numerous and probably has been becoming more numerous.
Okay, thank you.
And Ms. Fowler.
I want to mention up here, these are in the report, but we had sort of four recommendations of options. Of course, the options to council are limitless, but wanted to give you some idea of, you know, kind of where we stand with this.
Sky's the limit if you have four votes.
Sure. Thank you, Mayor. I'm going to recommend that we not take this up at this time. We have families that are in danger of losing their housing because of COVID. And for us to take up a discussion about making more housing available for short-term rentals, whether it be investor-managed or, I am not opposed to owner-hosted, but I am opposed to investor-owned properties removing housing from housing stock, it just feels like the wrong time to be doing that. We have families who are suffering and are concerned that if they lose their house, where will they go? And then to be creating processes that take housing out of circulation. I think we need to wait until we're on the other side of the COVID pandemic.
Are you okay with continuing the moratorium on the legal department's interpretation that these need to be enforced?
I'm uncomfortable with it, but I like that better than taking up this ordinance and creating something that we know in other cities, when we had more free time to study it, was having all kinds of side consequences.
One more comment. We've also got this as a report at the end of the meeting.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I mean, your reasons are obviously justified. I'm a little reluctant to do this. I don't want to get accused of kicking the can down the road. On the other hand, there's been a tremendous amount of controversy, even from our boards and commissions, the Planning and Zoning Commission on this, and none of this has really been resolved. It just continues to foment, if you will. And I think with the limited bandwidth that we have during this COVID, and even that has changed the picture in terms of how some of these things are affected. So I'd be inclined to collect some more data and get some more of this grounded, but to postpone this until such time as we can take up something more reasonably.
Okay. Any comments? I'll adjourn the pre-council meeting, and we will re-adjourn the regular meeting in 60 seconds.
My, aren't you efficient?
I'm on a little timetable.
Are you?